Welcome to another episode of Working Class. I'm your host, Attorney Ryan, and I'm here with a very special friend of mine, Jason. And if you don't know Jason yet, he's one of those warriors out there who's genuinely trying to make America a better place. And he has a big idea to help us fix a big problem. He's the founder of Sleep Trailer LLC. It's a company that helps homeless people find transitional housing. And he's doing great work. So, Jason, thank you for joining me on the show, man.
Well, thanks for having me. It's an honor to be here.
It's an honor to finally have you. I mean, we first met a couple of years ago. We did a little collab video. And for those who don't know, why don't you tell us a little bit about what Sleep Trailer LLC is?
Okay, that's a big question. So I am a guy, I live in Oregon, was seeing the homelessness increasing. And I just said, why isn't something being done? And so suddenly this punch to the gut came and it was like, why aren't you doing something? And I just went, oh, crap. Well, what would I do? What should I do? What do I think would be the best solution? And so what I came up with was what I call the sleep trailer. There's a little group picture of it. But it's got eight pods. So it's on a trailer. It's got eight pods in it. Each one has its own door, has its own window, CO2, smoke alarm. The walls are coated with a waterproof, like a truck bed liner coating. There's a drain in each floor so you can disinfect, clean it out. And we're just finishing up adding the heating and cooling in it as well. So it has heating and cooling as well, as long as you got a place to plug it in. So,
wow. So it sounds like it's almost like a mobile home, like an RV in a way, or a trailer is accurate, but it's got insulation. Yeah. It's got power.
Correct. So I modeled it kind of after capsule hotels, if you've ever seen those in Japan. Japanese capsule or business hotels is what sometimes they'll call them. But essentially, they're just like a tube like to sleep in.
I'm looking at it right now. These capsule hotels, it's literally just a little pod with maybe some space for a bed and a small amount of storage, but nothing else.
Right. And so my regular day job, I work for a nonprofit. We work with people with intellectual and developmental disabilities. And part of my job is I'm a behavior specialist. And so I like look at behavior and I try to see, okay, how can I help somebody get what they want in a more appropriate way? And kind of change behavior and behavior patterns. And so one of the basic things you need is safety and security for any type of behavioral change. Right. And so,
if I didn't want to interrupt, but I'm really glad you brought up the safety issue. So with these trailers you're making, are there locks? Are they able to secure themselves inside of here?
Yeah. So they have the locking door so they can lock it from the inside. They don't have to worry about, the outside. They have a window outside so they can kind of see what's going on. But a lot of people that I talk with, they really hate the congregate settings, like the big gym, open gym, with a bunch of mats everywhere. Cause you're like sleeping and you're 5 feet away from somebody that's having a mental health crisis, right? Like you're not going to sleep at all.
That's what I think a lot of people don't know. What a homeless shelter really looks like. What is the current status quo? There's a myth out there. Some of my opponents really think that people are just lazy. They don't want to work and the government is giving them money and a free place to live. And I work so hard. Why do they get all of this? And that really couldn't be farther from the truth. That's a huge misconception. Average homeless shelter, first of all, correct me if I'm wrong. There's never enough capacity for the local homelessness population. There's either some kind of wait list or there's very strict cutoff times. And if you're not first come, you're on the street that night.
Yep. Yeah. So there's different types of shelters. There's low barrier and high barrier. high barrier means they have to follow like a lot of rules and meet a lot of criteria. You know, they want them to be like, you have to be the perfect candidate essentially to even use the shelter. Whereas there's more and more, there's more shelters coming out that are low barrier, meaning they'll pretty much take anyone that needs a place to stay. And so mm-hmm. it really depends on the location, the state, and the where you're at. And so, but yeah, a lot of those low barrier shelters are very much at full capacity.
I believe it. Let's talk about those high barrier shelters. For starters, yeah. How common are they? And what kind of requirements do they impose on people who are looking for a place to sleep that night?
So typically when you're in a high barrier shelter, you're looking at somebody that is clean and sober, which can be a high barrier for a lot of people. They have to just meet different safety criteria, like, you know, they might have some mental health restrictions on it even, or some other things that may play into it. It's really going to depend shelter to shelter, but that like the sobriety one is one that is can be a big deterrent for a lot of people. Maybe pets. So a lot of people that experience homelessness have pets, and so they won't let them in the shelter if they have pets, or if there's two people, like let's say you're a couple, or like a parent and a kid, or something like that.
They won't allow parents.
Yeah, they wouldn't. It would depend on the shelter. There are some shelters that would.
Yeah. Well, that's right? Just a shame, because, you know, if you think someone who's experiencing homelessness, first of all, it's an incredibly dangerous state of existence.
Yep.
You are literally exposed to the elements. You're exposed to, depending on where you are, potentially wild animals, nuisance animals, even something like a raccoon or a coyote can be a threat to you. Just a bite can give you rabies. Even if it may not kill you, it's still a dangerous animal. Snakes, insects, things of that nature. And not to mention the world's most dangerous predator, other human beings.
Yep.
You have to be on alert. So, you know, sleeping with a family unit for security, I think, would be just a basic human need, or having a pet with you to help watch over you at night. And to say, oh, you can have shelter tonight, but you can't have your only companion.
Yep.
You can't have your family with you. That sounds kind of cruel to me. I mean, I don't want to knock a shelter that might be doing good work, but I mean, at what point do those requirements harm the homeless population more than they help?
That happens a lot, right? So people just are not, because, and that's the problem that I think a lot of people don't understand, is it's not a one size fits all problem. It's such a wide variety of people that experience homelessness. Like I meet mm-hmm. so many people that have full-time jobs that are living out of their car and homeless. You know, I meet so many people that like you would like never even know they were homeless. Because, you know, they just don't typically dress the way that people stereotypically think a homeless person might dress or look or appear. You know, there are so many people that experience homelessness. I've met a lot of people with this crazy like housing crisis that we're having right now. I've met people that had full-time jobs, full rent payers. The owner of the house comes in and they, with the high market, they go, okay, I'm going to sell it. And so they sell the house, the new owner comes in, kicks the renters out, makes a few upgrades, and then charges double the amount of rent that they were charging, the house was charging previous, and the people that were living there can't afford it anymore. And suddenly now they're homeless and they can't afford any place to rent because all the rent is way higher than it was, you know, 4 years ago.
It's really been crazy what's happened. I mean, really over the past 25 years, especially, it's why millennials are so jaded.
Right.
But it's been a steady incline of expenses over the past 25 years. And then it really blew up like that 2019, 2020, 2021, I think, is when we really saw things get out of hand. The pandemic accelerated it, but it was starting before. I think it's too simple to just point to the COVID pandemic and say, oh, it all started then. Like, this is a trend that got enhanced then. And it's tough. You mentioned you meet a lot of these people who you're trying to help, and they don't look homeless. I think there's this perception in America that homeless people should look a certain way. They're supposed to be dirty or wearing, you know, ratty clothes. And that's simply not true for a lot of people experiencing homelessness. That, you know, and I think part of the perception is maybe because we haven't figured out a solution that works yet, a lot of people would rather almost put homeless people in this untouchable caste. Like, not, it feels like people refuse to acknowledge their humanity sometimes.
Yes.
And just write them off and say they're dirty, they're street people, they're druggies, which none of that is fair. It's really not. So I want to kick this over to you. I mean, we have this sort of bias of what people think a homeless person looks like. Tell me some of the stories. Like, who are some of the people you meet and how they got to a point where they are homeless?
Yeah, so every story is just about as unique as an individual. For example, one thing that I've learned, because a lot of people, when you talk about people that experience homelessness, they immediately say, oh, drugs and alcohol, that's what caused this. That's what got them to that point, right? And a lot of the individuals that I have met that experience homelessness, that are using drugs, a large majority of them started after they became homeless, right? Because they became helpless and you get to that point where you're in that survivor mentality and you're not even sure if you're going to be around next week. Like, why do you care? Like, feel good.
It sounds like a sense of nihilism. Yeah, it sounds like a sense of nihilism creeps in. And that's what I'd like people to pick up on what you're saying. It's so easy to point and say, oh, these people, they're homeless because they deserve to be homeless. I think that's almost something people tell themselves.
Yep.
Because it feels better than, oh, man, these people are homeless because we screwed up. Like, they don't want the responsibility or the guilt.
Or they tell themselves that because it hasn't happened to them yet, right? Like if you're renting a place right now, if you're renting a place right now and the landlord sells it and kicks you out and doubles the rent, could you afford it? Mm-hmm. You know, and that's,
well,
that's
not even doubling. Not even doubling, Jason. I mean, it's gone up the past 4 years. There is a substantial portion of Americans, depending on who you ask and how you measure, the way you collect the data is going to skew it quite a bit. But anywhere from 40 to 60% of Americans live paycheck to paycheck. Yeah. And a good portion of those include people making greater than $75,000 a year.
Right.
I mean, these are people with full-time jobs, good paying jobs, and they live paycheck to paycheck. What does that mean? It means by the time they get to their next pay period, they're either out of disposable income or out of money entirely. Yeah. What makes that such a dangerous situation is your landlord doesn't have to double your rent. All they got to do is raise your rent $100, $200, or you know, what's more common, I think, I see this with my clients, is your cable bill went up $5 a month. Mm-hmm. You know, your utilities went up $40 a month. Wendy's is surge pricing. Your dinner went up $3. And so all of these little creeps are happening across all of your expenses. And then add to that stress an additional $100 or $200 of rent, and your paycheck hasn't really changed.
Yeah.
And you have to keep up with this. And so I think that's a way a lot of people in the past 4 years found themselves facing homelessness, even without a drug issue, even without an alcohol issue, even without a mental health issue, because those, if you ask the average American on the street, why are people homeless? I haven't done this. I'm just guessing. I think the average person would say mental health or drugs.
Yep. because that's what they see. That's the homelessness that's in their face. And that's what I'm saying is like, there's so much more that's happening out there that you don't even see because the person is in a car and they move place to place and they're better at hiding, you know, and kind of staying out of the public eye a little bit better or better at hiding it. And so like, I think that is one of the issues is that's the homelessness that people see and they go homelessness, right?
Yeah.
But that's not the full picture of what's going on and what's happening with so many people across the country.
So let's talk more about what's causing the issue. We know homelessness is on the rise and people blame various issues. We talked about some people blame drugs, some people blame alcohol. Me personally, I think the cost of living and the unavailability of affordable housing is certainly a culprit. But I wanted to read you a quote from Ronald Reagan that I find really upsetting because I feel that former President Reagan set the tone that a lot of policymakers have towards homelessness. And I want to know what you think about this. This is a speech in 1984. And what Reagan said here is a quote from Reagan. This isn't my words. What we have found in this country, and maybe we're more aware of it now, is one problem we've had, even in the best of times, is that people who are sleeping on the grates, the homeless who are homeless, you might say, by choice. For me personally, that is extremely upsetting to read from the President of the United States. One might say this is the person who is supposed to be the leader and we look to and say, hey, President, what are you going to do? What policy choices are you going to enact to make sure that quality of life for Americans improves? What are you going to do to improve quality of life for people? And he gets up there and says, well, first of all, if you're sleeping on a grate, it's your fault. So I'm not going to do anything. What do you think about that?
Well, so I think even some people experiencing homelessness might even tell you that they prefer sleeping on the streets. But
over a shelter?
Yeah. What they're saying sometimes is they prefer sleeping on the streets over the other options that are available to them, right? So, for example, like a lot of people, I was talking about the congregate shelters, right? So, like a lot of people have not had good experiences. They've had stuff stolen, they've had harm done to them in those shelters. And so, they don't want to go to a shelter like that. And so they will tell people or they'll say to people, yeah, I choose to live like this. And then people feel better about not doing anything. But I think in general, the human condition, if we create the right conditions, nobody would actually choose to be homeless.
No, I don't think so. And I think you brought up a really interesting point is when we say, oh, this person chose to be homeless. I think the perspective that some people might have is, oh, you chose to not work hard enough, which I find really upsetting when we have the statistics that show the number of people with full-time employment who experience homelessness. That's not even to say how difficult it is to have a job when you're homeless.
Yep.
For a lot of reasons. First of all, these homeless shelters are unfortunately not as safe as we'd like them to be.
Right.
There was a study. I'm actually looking at one right now. It's a study from Georgetown University. It was in the Georgetown Law Review, and it's quoting National Resource Center for Domestic Violence study says something of 92% of homeless mothers experienced some kind of sexual violence at a homeless shelter. 92%. Now, that's really high. I'd like to know what the sample size is, but I kind of believe it.
Yeah.
You put hundreds of people who don't know each other, who are already severely distressed on many levels. I personally, if someone tells me 92% of people experience sexual violence in those shelters, I believe it. And then when you think of the other issues, petty theft, you know, you have a bag of what few belongings you have. There's a risk that while you're sleeping, someone will take it from you because they're desperate. And not even to mention sexual violence, just regular violence.
An interesting thing on that is like when you don't have anything, the very few possessions that you do have become of an like huge worth, right? So I met this lady, she has like a PhD, like had a great job, and now she's experiencing homelessness, and she was getting, they do these like sweeps, I don't know, they probably do them where you're at as well, where the, like people are camping out at the parks and they come in and like kick everybody out. And then they go, hey, we
San Diego is, yeah, San Diego is very guilty of this. And Todd Gloria, if I don't know if you're listening, you probably aren't because you don't try very hard, in my opinion. But Mayor Gloria, you got to have a better solution than just sweeping homeless out of sight, because that doesn't fix the problem.
Correct.
And whether you like them and whether they're an inconvenience to you or not, they're still human beings and that's still their property. Unfortunately, yes, my town has a big black eye. San Diego is very guilty of these sweeps that you talk about. But let's get down to the nitty gritty. What happens in a sweep, Jason?
Well, so for this, well, and telling the story of this lady that I was talking with, she was talking about this styrofoam cup that was like blowing away in the wind. And she just like lost emotional control. Like she just started bawling because her cup like was running away and she wasn't able to catch up to it, you know? And it was interesting because like this was like, it had happened like months before. And she was just talking to me and she's like, I'm a smart person. I know it was just a cup and I can get another cup, but for some reason it meant so much to me because that was my cup, you know?
Well, so things were going, things were going badly too. Were. Yeah. I think, you know, for anyone who sees that, to an outside observer who doesn't have much empathy, I think their initial instinct would be, what a crazy person going bananas over a cup. This is why you're homeless. You're crazy. That's really unfair for a lot of reasons. And one of the best ones that I can point out is the way people behave in hospitals. You will see if you've spent any amount of time in hospitals with sick relatives like I have, you'll see it's a high stress situation for a lot of people. And they will go berserk over minuscule things, minuscule. They'll go berserk over a blanket not coming fast enough or, you know, their pudding wasn't the right thing. And it looks like irrational, crazy behavior, but it's not about the blanket and it's not about the pudding. And for this woman, I doubt it was not really about the cup. It was, I'm getting kicked so hard. I have one thing that brings me comfort. I've got this cup. I can go to a fountain. I can have water. And this one thing that brings me comfort is running away from me. The wind's taking it. And when you look at it that way, it's really easy to understand why someone would have a meltdown over something that maybe isn't that big of a deal, but it's just another kick in the gut.
Well, and it just goes back to like that, the importance of safety and security and what that could bring to so many people, right? Because that's the main focus of the sleep trailer. Like, nobody's going to get in the sleep trailer and go, hey, I want to live the rest of my life here, right? Like, it's not a forever home. It's not like their retirement plan. Like, the minute people get in, they start to feel safe. And with that safety comes, so when we did our pilot project, one of the great feedback that we got was the individuals that stayed in it would come up to me and say, oh my gosh, I have not slept that long in as long as I can remember. I slept for 12 hours straight and I can't remember ever sleeping for 12 hours straight in the last 5 years of my life, you know? And it was just like, it was so interesting. Like day two of the pilot project, when they like woke up that next morning, just this like light and this energy that they had that they didn't have the times before when they first were coming to the sleep trailer.
Yeah.
And so like, you know, thinking about like mental health and like stability, like sleep is number one thing that can impact your mood and mental health, your ability to be a rational and reasonable human being. You know,
I couldn't agree more. You know, I am so privileged. I am housed. I've always been housed. I mean, I slept in a truck once because I couldn't afford a hotel room, but that doesn't count. I was fine. I was just a college kid who couldn't afford a hotel. Like, I've always been housed. I have food, but, you know, I will have nights where work spikes for me and I sleep 3 or 4 hours, one or two nights in a row. And I know how irrational I become. I know, like, hey, I don't have a clear head because I'm sleep deprived. I need to cancel things. I can't be making important decisions in this condition. It's almost like being sick. And what happens is we have a whole population of people who are trapped in a perpetual cycle of sleep deprivation. And I think that's a sort of silent pandemic we don't talk about in homeless populations.
Exactly.
And this actually opens up to a couple of doors. Let's hit them on the head right now. Hostile architecture. Intentionally putting things like spikes and bars so that people can't sleep in a park, bright lights in public spaces so people can't sleep there, loud noises. I know there's a couple of towns in Florida where they blare music in parks to try to keep unhoused people away.
Around here.
And it's very cruel because, again, you're not making the homeless situation go away. You're simply saying, well, don't do it here. And then where they don't just cease to exist because seeing them is bothersome to you.
Right.
These are human beings. And then they go somewhere that's unsafe, that's unsanitary, and they're sleep deprived. And now you're saying, hey, you need to be part of this program. You need to fill out this paperwork. You have to pass this occupational exam. You have to hold down a job somehow. And if you don't do all these things, no shelter for you. Get no food stamp job. For you. No,
you gotta it's attend crazy. This meeting, and you got to show up to this place over here on this side of town, and then show up to this place over here on this side of town.
And you don't have transportation, and that's where I want to make a really big point. I doubt anyone listening to this podcast has this mindset, but maybe they've got a crazy MAGA uncle who does. I don't know. I see a lot of frustration from people who say, "Wow, well, this person deserves to be homeless because they can't even show up to work on time." Or they can't even show up for their mental health appointment. Like, clearly they don't care because they didn't show up to the shelter on time. It's like, think of yourself at your worst. You're most sleep deprived, you're hungriest, you're coldest, and you're least secure feeling. And also take away your phone and your watch. How good are you going to be at keeping your appointments without your phone, without your watch, without a clear head? Heck, even if I give you a phone, but add all those other things, I mean, how hard is it going to be to keep your appointments?
Or keep a job, right? Like, the people are get a job. Like, how? Like, how can you go to work, be a good employee for 8-10 hours, and then go leave, get zero sleep, come back the next day and be a good employee and do that for a month? Like, it's nearly impossible to do.
And it's a cruel joke that in this country, which is the richest country in human history that I'm aware of, we have people working full time and they don't have a place to sleep.
Yep, exactly.
So I think we've talked about this quite a bit. In your opinion, is homelessness a personal failure, a policy failure, or is it more complicated than that?
I think it's more complicated, but I think I would lean on the policy side of things a little bit heavier than anything else. You know, just obviously we don't have enough housing for the populations that we have. Or like I think systems like, you know, Airbnb right now, right, where you have these houses that are literally empty and they will never be on the market again. And once they are, you know, up, once somebody is renting it out in Airbnb and getting money from it, like, there's not a family that will ever occupy that house. And so that house is gone from the market. And so you need,
not unless they're on vacation. Yeah. But that's not exactly who we're trying to help right now.
Yep. And so building more housing, zoning for a lot of these things, there's so much, even for using the sleep trailer, there's so many like bureaucratic kind of hoops you have to jump through and get to be. And that's for somebody that's like out there trying and wants to be a solution. I still run into barriers, you know, and it's just crazy to me that I feel like there are ways that we could be doing better and supporting people better. And it's just not happening because of NIMBYism, because of zoning, because of policy.
For those who don't know, what is NIMBYism? N-I-M-B-Y. It's an acronym.
Yeah, that's not in my backyard. So everybody wants a solution for homelessness. They just don't want it anywhere near them. And so like they don't want it in their town. They want it in a different town, or they don't want it at that store because that store is too close to their house. And so
we have this problem in my neighborhood, the neighborhood I live in. I'm a huge proponent of high density mixed use zoning.
Yeah.
I mean, especially in a city center where I am. I mean, I'm just 10 minutes outside the center of San Diego. I'm like, look, why are we not building 3-4 stories up with stores and retail on the bottom? That makes so much sense. Like these tract homes that really blew up in like the 80s, these don't serve anyone. There's so much wrong with this system. And we could help a lot of people that way. And I'm fine living with apartments and things like that. But my neighbors, especially some of the ones who have been in the neighborhood longer, they fight to the death over this. They insist that it destroys the character of the neighborhood and we can't have it'll destroy the views. And it's like a neighborhood is a community of people who help each other and engage in commerce together and celebrate. You know, I really like my neighborhood. We have, you know, festivals and community events. I mean, wouldn't it be better if everyone was housed and instead of these tract homes, we had, you know, apartment communities with public squares that we can congregate in. And okay, yeah, there's an apartment building behind your home. There's way worse things, man. And it reduces crime. It makes your community safer when you provide for people. So all this to say, the NIMBYism, I really have a hard time respecting where they're coming from.
Yeah. Or like, I just think like at the very least, if you knew 100% that there was enough housing and that then those people that were experiencing homelessness, there is a bigger likelihood that that was a choice, right? But at least we would know that for sure, but we don't because there's not, you know? And so like, I think that's a different conversation. And that's why like, so the Sleep Trailer motto is building a bed for every head, because we just want every single person should have a safe place where they could sleep at night if needed. Right. And I think that goes to so many things. One of the things that I think about a lot is like domestic abuse, right? Mm-hmm. Like how many people, how many women would, if they knew they had a safe place to go tonight, mm-hmm. that they didn't have to worry about, like tonight it was covered, how many would leave tonight? You know, but so many are like, I'm gonna leave next week. And then next week comes and it's a little bit different. It's a little bit better. And so they stay. And then it happens, something really bad happens again. They go, okay, I'm leaving for real this time. Next week, you know, and
so we have a cycle of abuse that gets perpetuated because there's no safety valve. There's no safe place for someone to go. I mean, people talk about, you know, there are shelters for domestic violence victims, but again, they're going to be similar to a homelessness shelter where there's going to be probably an overcrowding issue. The resource may not be immediately available. And then there's not a lot of transition support. I'm not saying there's none. There's really hardworking people in the social service space trying to help. But the truth is, if you've got 16 of those full time in a city and you've got 15,000 people experiencing homelessness or short term displacement because of a domestic violence issue, that's not enough resources. They're going to be overwhelmed.
Yeah. The ones in my area are always full. There's like almost never an opening, and there's a huge wait list for those.
Yeah, I think that's why I get so, I just see red, Jason. I get so enraged when people say, oh, just take advantage of the programs, or oh, Obama gave you all phones, or oh, just go to the shelter, quit whining. It's like, those are ignorant statements from a person who has never witnessed homelessness. I mean, I never experienced it, but I was a witness for a few years as a firefighter when we would go on these calls. We would, because the truth is, people experiencing homelessness are more likely to need emergency services because their whole state of being is just so perilous.
Right.
And that's, I mean, that's definitely what gave me some perspective, was being part of the first response system and just seeing how difficult it is to survive.
Yeah, I mean, people are not at their best. They're not in their right frame of mind a lot of those times, you know, and it's just, it's not, they're not even given a fair chance. And so, like, that's kind of what I always think back to with the sleep trailer, is just like, it's not everything, but it's a chance, right? It's a chance for you to stabilize, to sleep, to get your mind right, and to figure out whatever that next
5 minutes. Yeah. I love it. So let's talk about the trailer itself and some of the solutions, because we talked a bit about the problems here. We know what the problems are. There's simply nowhere safe, and the places that are safe, the barriers to entry might be too high. So what does a person have to do to get a pod in one of your trailers? Let's say I'm homeless. I lost my place, and I come to you. What criteria do I need to satisfy?
So we would be a low barrier option. There's not a whole lot. Although we don't demand sobriety, there is no drug use or alcohol use on the site. So that would be a rule, but somebody might be under the influence and still be able to get in the shelter, as long as they
can't have a beer inside my pod.
Not inside the pod. No, that would be outside the pod and then come in. But as long as you are respectful and a good neighbor to everybody else, right? If you're yelling and screaming and banging on the walls, like, obviously you're not going to be able to stay in the sleep trailer. Like, pet friendly. So people that, for our mini pilot project, there were a few individuals that had pets that stayed with them, which was really awesome. And, you know, their pets were really cute and loved it. And, you know, they people got to actually stretch out and sleep, because there were a couple of the individuals were people that were sleeping in their car. Wow. So if you've ever slept in your car, like, it's not a comfortable night's sleep, right? And so
I've only done it a few times in my life, and they were never a good night's sleep. Also, they were not times things were going particularly well for me.
Right.
And those were all times when I had a home to return to. Yeah. I was just kind of out, you know, doing something. The most I ever slept in my car was 3 or 4 nights in a row, is for this hazmat training thing I was doing way out in Barstow, and I couldn't afford a hotel. It's when I was a really young firefighter, and I couldn't afford even the cheap hotel. I was so broke back then, and I just slept in my Tacoma those nights. But and I remember I was exhausted.
Yep.
Just trying to sleep in my pretty safe pickup truck. Right. But I like what you're doing. So people can come to the pod. They can't use drugs or alcohol at the pod. They're not really supposed to be under the influence, but it sounds like if they're just a respectful neighbor, we let quite a bit slide.
Yeah. Well, and even there's no like rule on like they can't be even if they are intoxicated or something, as long as they are a respectful neighbor.
Now, what about, you know, it's pods, so they're isolated cells. Yep. What's the plan for things like communicable disease? Because one issue that came up in San Diego, I called out our mayor because I'm not a huge fan of him. I'm upset with him, actually. Our city opened up our convention center during the pandemic, which is great. It's not a perfect solution. It has problems, but I'm glad we did that instead of nothing. I want to be very clear. I'm glad we did that. It's better than nothing. But it became a hotbed of just communicable disease transition, because now you've got everyone in this kind of packed environment. And I don't want to blame the people working in that shelter. They're doing the best they can with what they have, but how does your solution help?
Well, so they got their own individual pod, right? So they're not mm-hmm. in the same like space as other people. It's outside mm-hmm. As well. So that helps kind of alleviate it. Now there is in the unit that I have right now, the prototype, there is ductwork in it. But in that ductwork, we have some filtration systems,
nice.
Including like some light. I can't remember what the actual name is, but it's like a light that shines and kills most of the bacteria and kind of sanitizes.
One of those UV
it goes back in.
It's like a UV light, right? I think I've seen that. Yeah, there were a couple companies that sprouted up when the pandemic was really peaking, and they would go to businesses and be like, "Yeah, they're kind of wacky. They're these like 3-4 foot tall rods that they set up in a room, and then they go outside and they click a button and just bling, and it shines the light, and it's supposed to kill a bunch of bacteria. I don't know if it kills viruses. I don't know if it can, but supposedly it sterilized things.
Yep. Yeah. So
you've got that in the ductwork.
Yep. That's in the ductwork so that it kind of cleans and sanitizes it. And then obviously if somebody, let's say an individual is sick, that use the pod, you know, when they're done, you can disinfect the pod, clean it out, disinfect it. Like I said, it's got the truck bed liner
coating, the drain
in the floor.
Yeah.
So you can really clean it out and make sure that all the, any disease that is left is taken care of.
Yeah. Well, this might be a stupid question, Jason, but if communicable diseases are a concern, why do we have ductwork connecting all the pods, and why don't we just have vents directly outside? I'm sure you've thought about that.
And we could.
I don't know why.
There are vents that go outside. So the only difference, so it would depend on whoever's buying the unit. So if they wanted it that way, for us, it was a matter of power and use, because if it's each pod has its own like heating and cooling, then
it's
electricity that you're going to have to use to run that.
I see. Yeah. So just to keep it climate controlled, you have to do it that way. Yeah. I should have thought about that. That makes sense. I'm glad you're climate controlled.
Yeah. I mean, ideally what I would do is like a radiant heat type system that could either heated tiles or heated ceilings. So it would radiate heat, and then you're not sharing that ductwork. But the downside of that is that it doesn't cool. So that would be great for the heating, but that doesn't help out in the cooling aspect, which right now I got a mini split. So it does heating and cooling.
Well, we need both, especially, I mean, in my
community, San Diego.
cooling is going to be needed. Well, we're nothing. I mean, you go to Phoenix of all places, of course, and then Texas gets hot beyond all measure.
Yep.
I'm just thinking of, man, I was in Dallas and I saw quite a bit of people experiencing homelessness. And I can't imagine how just miserable summer must be for those people on top of everything else that they have to deal with.
Yeah, I get a lot of calls from organizations and people in Texas that are really interested in the sleep trailer. And that's kind of the beauty of it too, right? It is customizable. So if you're going to a place that's really cold like Canada, you know, you could beef up the insulation and make the heating the main focus. And so you could do it that way. If you're going to a place where AC and cooling is the main focus, you could do it that way. And so it's very adaptable to wherever it's needed. And that's kind of the beauty of it, is it is a flexible unit in itself because it is so simple. It's not like a super complex design, right? Like, doesn't take a genius to go, "Hey, 8 spots."
Yeah. It's a really simple solution. And I like that it's mobile because you can sort of migrate with where the need is greatest. And you can and it's also one of those things, you know, one of the pushback I see with NIMBYism, say, well, we don't want a homeless shelter, because in their minds, they think homeless shelter equals undesirable people. I know that's so horrible to say, but they won't say that part out loud, but that's what they really mean.
Right.
They don't want what they perceive to be the kinds of people who experience homelessness in their area. And they also don't want crime, because here's another issue I see. it is true that when there's more homelessness, you see crime statistics spike. That's true. But it's not fair to say that homeless people or people experiencing homelessness necessarily cause crime. One issue that I think people need to be aware of is we are a country that basically criminalizes homelessness. And by that, I mean trespassing becomes a misdemeanor or some kind of criminal charge when someone's caught sleeping in a park. So we have a situation where people commit a crime and get arrested because they sat down in the wrong place. That is upsetting when you think of the sort of domino effect that creates. First of all, it will affect your crime reporting statistics. And so opponents of homeless solutions say, oh my God, look at all the crime these people are doing. Look how bad they are. Look at my graph. Look how bad the crime is. And when you get into the details, it's like, wait a minute. One person experiencing homelessness in the community was cited 43 times for misdemeanor trespassing. Is that really a hardened criminal, or is that a person who just sat down for a minute?
Person
that's and just then you take it a step exist. Further. Oh, what's that?
I said a person that was just trying to exist. Excuse them.
Exactly. You were existing in the not an approved place. And I'm not saying trespassing is okay. I'm just saying, look, someone wanted to sleep in a parking lot and, you know, a cop rolled up and cited them. And now that creates another problem. Now we've got these people who are struggling and trying to get reintegrated into society somehow, get a home, get an apartment, get a job that can help them get those things. And now they've got these criminal citations on their record. So now we took a person who can barely get an apartment as it is, even if they came into some money. I mean, a landlord's going to look up and see a criminal record and is less likely to approve them. An employer is less likely to offer them a job, all because they tried to sleep in a park.
Well, and that's kind of one of the cool things about the sleep trailer is that flexibility piece and the NIMBYism, right? Because you can go to a community and let's say you pick four church parking lots that are spread out throughout the city, right? And you rotate every 3 months from one church parking lot to the next. And then then no neighborhood has it forever, right? And so you can go to those neighbors that are like, no, we can't have that. Look, it'll only be here for 3 months.
That's an easier sell. Yeah, I bet that's an easier sell. And that doesn't require us to change anyone's mind.
Right.
Because I think it's a lot harder to convince someone who, I don't know why, personally, I think it's really sad. They just don't want to be part of the solution.
Yep.
They don't want to see it. They want to pretend it's not real. And they just, to me, that's a person who doesn't understand how a community works. But either way, we're going to be less likely to change that person's mind than we are to get them on board with a compromise. Be like, look, okay, you don't want to see it. You don't want to know what's happening, but just let us park in the church for 3-4 months and then we're gone.
Then we're out of your hair. Well, and what's really interesting is like, that is how you change minds, right? Because we did our pilot project and like we talked to the neighbors around afterwards and they're like, oh, I didn't even realize that was happening. You know,
they didn't didn't even notice any changes, no differences, nothing.
And they're like, wow, great. You know, like that's awesome. You know? And it was just kind of.
They can't even throw you a bone and say, hey, we noticed fewer encampments. Just didn't. I mean, dude, solutions for this help everyone. They really do.
Yeah.
It's not, I mean, it is altruistic, but it's not pure altruism. Like we all benefit from it.
Right.
So looking at locations for these things, that's going to be the number one pushback I get. Where have you had success parking these trailers?
So where we're looking, so for our mini pilot project, we did it in a church parking lot. In a small town in Oregon called Lebanon. They were awesome. They happen to also be, they run the soup kitchen like 2 or 3 times a week, like Monday, Wednesday, Friday. And so they already had like that population was already kind of coming there. So it was really easy to connect and find those people.
That's literally a match made in heaven.
Yeah.
The churches and because they've got the soup kitchen, they've got volunteer staff. And I would presume that a lot of the churches who are open to having you use their facilities, they probably have a community outreach program.
Yeah.
And they're probably, I mean, I don't know how they are with mental health professionals or vocational assistants or anything like that, but at least they're down.
Yeah.
Like at least you go to them and they're like, yeah, no, we're about that. Like bring in your trailer. And by the way, here's some soup. I love that.
Yeah. And they were just awesome. They're just some of the greatest people. And they like, you know, and that's kind of the nice thing about something that is mobile and moving, right? Is it, mm-hmm. it doesn't burn somebody out, like a place out, right? Because if something's in a, like a church parking lot, let's say it was in there for a year, you know, the congregation and everybody, like there, yeah. People get burnt out, like helping out, volunteering, always, you know, but if it was moving to a different location every 3 months, you know, people can chip in and are more willing to chip in for 3-4 months before it's moved to the next location.
I think you're less likely to find resentment that way.
And then the other one that's a really good opportunity, it hasn't happened yet, but we're in like, we're having the conversations for it, would be already existing shelters, right? And so you have shelters that are already at full capacity, and then you bring in the sleep trailer and suddenly you're able to help 8 more people that they weren't able to help, but those 8 people get their own private space.
Or kind like, of the VIP lounge. The demand's going to be high. And I do want to point out, someone listening might hear the numbers and say, wow, big whoop, Jason, you helped 8 people.
Yep.
The homeless shelter is overbooked by 100. You helped 8. 8 is infinitely more than 0 people. Look, I'm not saying we have to fix everything with one swipe of a magic wand, but incremental progress is how we get to big changes. I'm making your case for you, I guess, but what do you think?
Yeah, so like somebody gets in and they're able to stabilize and they're able to get out of homelessness,
mm-hmm.
right? And then somebody else comes in and is able to, you know, when you actually look, let's say it takes 3 months for somebody to stabilize, you know, that means each pod, you could have like 4 people a year that are able to be supported. And then every year that compounds, right? It's not something that diminishes over time.
It's not like you just fix, you know, you don't just help 4 people and then that's it. It's not like the trailer is spent. And also these trailers do 8 now, but the more trailers you have and the more they get used, this can become an exponential effect. It needs to get a fair shot.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's the real part that we're at, is just what we really need. And the biggest barrier that I run into is I get counties calling and states calling me and organizations calling me so excited, so interested, until mm-hmm. they hear that it hasn't been done on a longer pilot project. Right. It's just a concept. And so like everybody's interested, but nobody wants to be the first. You know what I mean? And so that's why we just got this grant and it's for a year-long pilot project. And so if we can get everything in a row, like I really think this will open the door for a lot of other organizations, not just in Oregon, but across the country. And even in, I get a lot of calls from people in organizations in Canada, tribes, you name it. So I feel like it could help a lot of people.
What is the concern? Because I would think, you know, it's really not that complicated. You set up the trailer somewhere, you move it every 3 months, and hopefully you combine it with some sort of vocational training, some sort of mental health, maybe a soup kitchen. Like you combine it with other services, and then this can help your unhoused population, which, by the way, they're just as much a part of the community as everyone else.
Yep.
They deserve just as much support as the support we would give to a housed person. They're still members of your society.
Yeah.
What is their concern when they say, oh, we don't want to be first for a long-term project? What are they worried about?
They're just worried about like if it goes wrong, right? Like let's say it doesn't work or it, you know, whatever. Everybody wants to bet on a sure thing. You know what I mean? So new ideas, people are often a lot slower to adopt, right? Because it's mm-hmm. never been done before, right? So if it's never been done before, like, I don't want to take that shot being the first to do it. But if a few people test it out, prove it, I think there's a lot of people that are ready and willing to jump in and make it happen. But it's just getting that first initial movement.
Yeah. So who are your top candidates right now? Do you have anyone who looks like they're close?
Yeah, nobody that I could say publicly yet, because nothing's finalized yet.
I understand.
We do have, we're in conversations with lots of different organizations. So our grant is just for Lynn, Benton, and Lincoln County in Oregon. Mm-hmm. So it's kind of a narrow zone. So it's not open to anywhere and everywhere.
What do you hope might happen in the next 5 years? I mean, do you think you could end up outside of Oregon or in a major city or something long term? What do you hope in the next 5 years is going to look like?
Honestly, just that everybody that wants a place can have a safe place to sleep, whether that's with Sleep Trailer or not. I think that's...
You're going to need more than 5 years, I think.
The goal
I try
here,
not to be too
right?
cynical.
Well, yeah. if I'm the only one doing it, right?
Yeah, it's going to be a while.
Let's say if we start a movement and we show this thing really rocking, then people are going to copy that idea or that... it's not like this is complex to build, right? So it's a pretty simple design, pretty simple concept to create. And so if it goes countrywide, it could help a lot of people really quickly. Because the real answer is more affordable housing, right? It's not sleep trailers everywhere, because that's not the world you want to live in, where everybody's just living out of a sleep trailer. But that those sleep trailers could help people now in the meantime while that affordable housing is being
built. And there'd be a dual use too. I could see organizations like FEMA or Red Cross. We look at things like hurricanes in the Gulf Coast, we look at wildfires in my community, tornadoes in Middle America. I would love to see governments invest money and keep fleets of these, and then they can have them for, what's cool about them moving is let's say you have a homeless population in San Diego and you serve that population with a fleet of these trailers. And over time, ideally you have less need for the trailers as time goes on. You're helping people transition. And then LA calls and says, hey, we got a wildfire and we've got, 300 displaced families, and you can move those units for disaster preparedness. I mean, these trailers aren't just, for homelessness. They can help with a lot of things that a community needs. It seems like a city would be really wise to have a fleet of them.
Yeah. I mean, if you think about so emergencies and disasters, or prison release reintegration programs, like people that get out of jail, and instead of them going back to their old places and their old habits, hey, stay here for a while until you kind of get on your feet and figure out a different path. And so we don't have people just going back into the system and back into the system, or drug and alcohol rehabs, facilities that are often overbooked and crowded, women's shelters, warming shelters, refugees, firefighters.
It's funny you mentioned the firefighter thing. I could see, it sucks that we have to think this way, but it's just the nature of being an American. Every good idea to help people, we have to figure out a way for it to make money.
Yeah.
I just think that's the only way it gets anywhere. Yeah. And if anyone's listening and you're an entrepreneur, I'll tell you what, as a former wildland firefighter, learning how to service those camps, if you can supply fuel trucks, water trucks, mobile kitchens, mobile showers, sleep pods like this, you make good money. Those are good government contracts to get. I actually had a friend I went to high school with, and his dad had a fleet of fuel trucks, and that's what he would do. They would follow during wildfire season and just ship fuel to base camps for firefighters. Oh, yeah, we used them all the time.
Yeah.
So all that to say, this isn't just a big humanitarian opportunity, but it could be a business opportunity too. Yeah. Like, do you have any interest in this being something you franchise out? And maybe there's someone in Florida who purchases a bunch of these and they contract with governments for disaster aid and homeless aid, something like that.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that is kind of the dream. Like, obviously, like, my heart, my desire is for it to be an aid and a help for people experiencing homelessness. But mm-hmm. I also see the potential and you know, that if doing that helps me do what I want to do, I'm all in. I'm all for it. But like you said, I would definitely need somebody else to kind of come in and partner with me on that. I mean, even if it was for somebody that just wanted to open up a hostel or like a airport overlay location where mm-hmm. people could just sleep while they're waiting for their flight to that got delayed or anything.
It's so funny. It sounds like what we're basically doing is we're trying to find a way to just get these things out into circulation one way or another, just get them out there and then say, oh, counties, cities, states. I mean, we've got 50 of these things. Why don't we help some people? You know, talk about the millennial condition. God,
we're not using these two. We have 10. We're not using these two trailers. Why don't you just take those?
Yeah. Would it be easier to get some of your zoning and everything approved if you weren't immediately going for the homeless? Why is that the case? That's so messed up.
Well, it's the NIMBYism, right? It's the
it all goes back to that.
The political sphere, right? Like, no person on the city council or, you know, in politics want to have their name behind, you know, something that, you know,
brings, I don't understand,
in their mind, why brings crime or whatever their fear is.
I guess it
is.
Depends on what voter base you're appealing to.
Right.
Exactly. I don't know. Maybe for me as a workers' rights lawyer, I've gotten so much pushback from certain communities that I've just stopped trying to appease them. Like, I've just made up my mind, like, dude, nothing I say resonates with you. You don't like when I talk about safe, fair work conditions. You don't like when I talk about making life more affordable because you think I'm pandering, whatever. I just try not to appease those people. So for me personally, I mean, heck, if I had a town that was experiencing homelessness, I'd be pretty interested in any solution to that. So I got it. This is a tough question to ask an hour in, but are there people who profit or benefit from homelessness?
Sure.
Is there
any
kind of financial stake people have that would incentivize them to resist you?
Yeah. So, and this is, you know, this has just kind of been my experience where and this is more of a feeling than anything else, but, there's lots of grants and opportunities out there, but people see that as you taking their money, right? And so they don't want you to get that grant because then they can't get it. And so it can be a pretty competitive area, even though, like, look around, there's plenty of people to help, right? There's plenty of people that need to help. And so we need lots of different solutions. It's not.
So we're fighting over grant money. Man, this is dark, but I've had this experience as a workers' rights lawyer. I've had whistleblower cases where basically people worked in a nonprofit that, so off the top of my head, we had one where purportedly the nonprofit helped kids who I think were experiencing some kind of displacement from their homes. Like, it was similar to homelessness. I don't remember exactly what it was, but the problem was this place got grants from the government, my client noticed that they were claiming on their roster more kids than were actually using the program. They were making up fake kids to show, oh, look at our, all the people are helping give us more look money.
How much we're helping. And what
exactly.
We're
and then my client was like, whoa. Like, we're defrauding the government and taking money that could go elsewhere. And what are we doing with it? And it's the people who controlled the nonprofit just wanted that money for personal use. And it's, I don't want anyone getting the idea that all nonprofits are bad. They absolutely are not. I'm certain that most are good. But that does happen. There are people who take advantage of these grants, you know, and well, I think,
and I'm an LLC. So Sleep Trailer is an LLC, but we have a nonprofit fiscal sponsor. And I kind of think that's actually like the best of both worlds, right? Because you make a donation through the nonprofit to Sleep Trailer. That can't go to my salary. That can't go to anything for me. I have to request it from them specifically for the building Sleep Trailers or like adding the heating and cooling in the Sleep Trailers. So it's kind of a cool like best of both worlds things where people can make a tax deductible donation, but also have the assurity that it's not going towards, you know, me. It's going.
Yeah. That's a big push. A lot of people have is they say, well, how much of every dollar does Salvation Army spend on programs for people and how much of it goes towards, you know, the executives? Cause I know there was, this was 20 years ago. I might be wrong. It was a long time ago, like 15, 20 years ago. It was, man, let me look this up. I think it was Salvation Army, and it was like the CEO was making something like $400,000 a year. It was right? bad. This was, yeah.
And that's, let me that's see where your was. Donations are going towards, really. You know, that's sad.
No, it says here it's only $94,000 a year, but that was in 2003. Maybe it wasn't Salvation Army. I don't want to
bad mouth an organization.
No, I don't want to. Maybe it wasn't them, but I remember there was this big exposition page, and I don't remember where it was, but it was basically like, yeah, there was this nonprofit, and the CEO was making like $400,000 a year and had a Rolls Royce that he had deducted as a business expense. Like, it was just crazy. So people have good reason to be skeptical of some of these nonprofits. But I like what you're doing because you're basically saying you're part of the LLC. So money can't flow from your nonprofit to the LLC without, first of all, triggering a taxable event.
Right. Well, it's I'm not part of that nonprofit at all. They're called Crossroads Communities, and they specialize in building affordable housing, and they're just a great community partner. And so they saw the potential of like, hey, let's get people off the street now and into the Sleep Trailer while we're building affordable housing. And that seems like the perfect match, you know? And so they take the tax deductible donations, but it's in a separate account that's specified for Sleep Trailer. And so people can make those donations specifically for the Sleep Trailer. And then
that's good. I like that, man. And I'm sure we put some people to sleep when we started talking about taxes. But, you know, there's one more thing I wanted to get into today. And that's what are some warning signs you see in people that they're at risk of homelessness? Like, a lot of people seem to think, oh, it can't happen to me because I work hard, or it can't happen to me because I don't do drugs. So what are some things that caught people by surprise or that were like, wow, these were things that I really couldn't control and they led to homelessness?
Yeah. So like the big one is living paycheck to paycheck, right? Which a large majority of people do. And then you throw in anything, right? So it could be a huge medical bill or expense that you weren't expecting, an accident that happens, divorce. That's a big one. Like,
really?
People go through a divorce and they just kind of lose everything. And I've seen that in multiple cases. And so it's really just like having some type of an like emergency type fund or something to be able to be free of those big events, because it's going to happen, right? We all go through stuff in life. It's inevitable. But just not being able to
if your paycheck to paycheck, an emergency fund isn't happening, especially now. I mean, I was, it was something like, what have grocery prices gone up, like between 20% and 30%?
I don't know.
Depending on where you collect your data from, like just grocery bills are going up. Yeah. Rent's going up. There's some places where it's much higher, but it's, the point is, you know, I really get frustrated with people who come from the Dave Ramsey school of thought. They were like, oh, it's just fine. You're financially irresponsible. And it's like, bro, what do you mean? Like, I earn X amount. Government takes a fat percentage of it because payroll tax, you know, people pay, not payroll tax, income tax already dings you. Now you've got your rent, which is really half of a lot of people's pay. They say it's supposed to be 25-30% to be responsible, but that's just not the reality anymore. People spend half of their paycheck on rent alone. And now you factor in utilities, medical insurance, if you're lucky enough to have it, an emergency medical bill if you didn't have insurance, but you're still going to get sick. It's dangerous out there if you're paycheck to paycheck.
Yeah, or like most people like live in a two income house, you know, like to afford rent, you have to have two incomes to be able to afford it.
And that's where it's gone, is where everyone needs to work. And a lot of people need to work more than one job just to make ends meet. So what are the, in your opinion, Jason, based on what you've seen, what are the best preventative measures we can take to help just people not end up in a homelessness situation?
Oh, that's a good question.
Yeah, I'm asking you to fix everything right on the fly.
Right? How do you prevent? I don't know if we can, unfortunately, in our current system or state, right? With inflation, with rising housing prices, I don't know if it's possible without affordable housing or other alternatives, right? Because I think if 80% of people lost their current residence right now, they wouldn't be able to afford the new rent prices that are out there today.
Oh, and not to mention just getting approved.
Yeah.
Because you have to show 3 times income in a lot of places, which if you lose your job, well, there goes your shot. And then even if you have a good job, just they keep raising the rents at these places. It's crazy.
Yeah, I just don't really feel like it's this as we currently are, that it's sustainable.
Do you have an opinion about short-term rentals, Airbnb? I saw a pretty interesting headline earlier today, and it said that in some communities, short-term rentals take up as much as 40% of available rental units.
Yeah.
And you mentioned the problem earlier today. You basically said, look, that's fine. It's a home, it's a shelter, but it's being occupied by people on a short temporary basis. And no, these are not people experiencing homelessness.
Right.
These are people who had several hundred or several thousand dollars to burn for generally a vacation.
For a week or two. Yeah.
A week or two. So what we've done is we already started off with a general lack of supply, which really got bad in 2006, 2007, 2008, 2009. That's where we saw a lot of stalling and new development and this recession that followed. So already we're behind the eight ball. And then in the mid 2010s, a bunch of tech bros got the idea that they wanted to be the Uber of hotels. What if we had a hotel that charged you a cleaning fee and made you clean anyway? That's Airbnb. And now we're gobbling up a not insignificant portion of housing supply in a community.
Well, and like if you or I buy a house, like when we're done or we die, like that goes back into the market, right? But so many of these people,
ideally,
they start a business and the business buys the property. And so that business just changes ownership. And so that house will never again for the future duration of that house be on the market for anybody else to purchase.
That's rough, because one thing people need to realize is that it's all connected. It's a circle here. Having more luxury housing or large single family homes, I mean, yeah, that's not exactly the kind of supply we're looking for with low income housing, but that still puts a family unit somewhere.
Yep.
And, you know, you'll have people who are able to live in an environment like that. Maybe they can afford the higher rent, but it's just not available. So now you have someone who is in a less expensive unit, a less expensive home they're renting, a less expensive apartment, and they don't move. Maybe they want to move, but it's just everything around me is a short-term rental.
Yeah, and they can't because they can't afford the prices for what's
So more supply helps everyone, although ideally we want to see the affordable stuff. So overall, I'm not saying if you have property, you can't do what you want with it.
I mean, I understand why people do it.
It's tough. Like, I don't want to boss people around and tell them, hey, you can't do what you want with your property. But at the same time, if what you're doing with your property is a net drain on the community, that's a bit of a problem, isn't it? It's like, yeah, you can have a giant sound system in your home and you can play that music. It's your home. Do what you want. But if you're playing that loud music at 11, 12, 1 o'clock in the morning, keeping your neighbors up, wouldn't it make sense that we say, hey, you're not allowed to play your music at that time? Like, chill out, dude. And that's a really clumsy example, but all I'm trying to say is if what you do with your property is a net negative on people, you are increasing housing to a point where average working class people can't afford to live in the community anymore.
Yep.
You're depriving people of so many units that now we're seeing a spike in homelessness. At that point, I think it makes sense that we together say, hey, maybe we limit the number of short-term rentals in this community.
Yeah, I mean, it's not even just that too, right? Mm-hmm. Like, think about just rental management companies in general, right? A house goes on the market, you know, a family isn't competing with other families. They're competing with management companies that are purchasing those houses up. And
you're never going to outbid Blackstone.
Yeah.
It's just not going to happen. Yeah.
It's just like an impossible game. And, you know, people have been dealt such a tough hand. And I just like, it's so heartbreaking to see it kind of that no end in sight right now, you know, and you just, you know, we need to start building more. We need to start creating more. We need to open up land for development or else, you know, it's just not going to be feasible.
Yeah, it's going to get to a point where we have people who are sleeping in cars or are truly homeless, and we have thousands, tens of thousands of homes they could live in just sitting empty because some corporation owns them and is just holding on to it for the value, or it's only for short-term rental because they decided that's their highest margin. Yeah. And we need to get to a point as a country where we stop measuring everything we do in how much profit we can generate for shareholders or what we can do with the stock price. Like, I'm not saying all capitalist ventures are bad, and I'm not saying all solutions to it are good, or, you know, I don't want anyone to take this more extreme than it is, but we need to stop measuring everything in this country by profit incentives. Yeah. There's some things where they probably should run at a net loss. I think fire departments are a great example. There are for-profit fire services out there, but we wouldn't have very safe communities if all fire services were for-profit.
Yeah.
Because really, a good fire service is going to run at a massive, we call it a loss, but it's not really a loss. It's an investment in the community. We're investing in a safe community. We're investing in having ambulances and fire trucks available when there's an emergency. So I think that's how we need to look at housing. Not all housing development needs to be a profitable endeavor. Sometimes it's an investment in the community.
Right. And it's investment for the community. Yeah. I'm part of an organization that's like looking at and working on some of that. Part of like a think tank group. It's really cool to see, just kind of the ideas but it really comes down to that. Just like, let us build, you know?
Yeah. It's wild. You have a solution ready to go, and you've had this for at least 2 or 3 years now that I've known you. And you're still trying to get people to just let you show them that it works.
Yep.
And if it doesn't work, I don't see how it couldn't. I mean, it's really simple. You put a homeless person in the pod and look, they had a nice safe place to sleep. In my opinion, that worked, you know, but Jason, just before we wrap up, do you have just some basic myths and facts that you come across in your work where people's perception of homelessness might be off base?
Yeah, I mean, just what we've talked about already, it comes in so many different shapes and sizes and stories and what gets people there. And like, I really think if you meet one person that experiences homelessness, you've met one person that experiences homelessness, right? It's not that everybody's the same, or we want so badly to put everybody in a box, but that's really not the case. I've seen people from all sorts of different backgrounds, great homes, bad homes, you know, normal homes, you know, and it's just not, if you really got out there and met people experiencing homelessness, I feel like you'd have a totally different understanding of it.
I think you're right. And from my prior experiences, I would just say people, just because you don't see a tent doesn't mean homelessness is not a problem in your community.
Yeah.
Just because you see a group of maybe 10 or 12 people in a homeless encampment, and maybe that camp is covered in trash. Maybe, well, first of all, they got nowhere else to put it. So what do you think was going to happen? But it's covered in trash. It's covered in waste, and it's dangerous. And there's people with a bat or something. Again, those people are put in a position where they're incredibly unsafe and they have nowhere else to put these things. So try to give them a little bit of grace, but it's not fair to say, oh, that encampment is dangerous, therefore all homeless people are dangerous. You're looking at just the most visible part of the problem. Right. And what you may not realize is a car parallel parked on the street. There's a family living in that car, you know, or maybe an unseen portion of the city, because it's the only place where there is not heavy-handed police or hostile architecture there. So they go out of sight. So I want to caution people that, one, homelessness doesn't always look the way you think it looks. The worst representatives of what we think a homeless person might look like, that's just your most visible. There is a lot of invisible homelessness in your community. So again, just because you don't see tents doesn't mean it's not a problem in your neighborhood. Jason, this has been an awesome talk, man. Yeah. Thank you for making the time to talk about what you're doing. I can't imagine how frustrating it must be trying to make this work, but you're always doing it with a smile on your face. Please tell people where they can find you, and more important, how they can support you if they feel so inclined to do so.
Yeah. So sleeptrailer.com. And then on all the social media apps, TikTok, Facebook, Instagram, Sleep Trailer LLC is the handle there. TikTok, I have a good size following. Instagram and Facebook, I got like nothing. And YouTube.
So we'll get you on the Instagram then. It's at
Sleep
Trailer LLC.
Like 500. followers or something.
You need a lot more than that, because a lot more people need to know to come to a neighborhood looking to do it, they know who you are. And if someone wants to help you out, how can they help you out?
So through our website, sleeptrailer.com, or email me, jason@sleeptrailer.com. And through our website, there's the donation link if people want to make donations through Crossroads Communities, which is an awesome organization. I've really loved working with them. Open to any ideas or help or hope for that.
That's awesome, man. Well, I love it. I'm looking at it right now. We'll put this up somewhere where people can see it. Jason, thank you so much for everything you're doing to make the world a better place. Thank you for the way that you deal with it, bro. Always good talking to you. And I'll catch you next time, all right?
All right. We'll see ya.